Today on Piano Jazz, my guest is actor, director, composer, and piano player Clint Eastwood. He's done so much for jazz in so many ways, and today I'm looking forward to hearing him play. Clint, how are you?
Well, I'm great, Marion, but looking, when you said piano player, you could say more of an aficionado of piano players.
Well, that's fine, but how did you actually start listening to jazz when you were a little kid? How did you get started?
Well, I listened to a program. There was a little bit of a resurgence of Dixieland jazz in the San Francisco Bay Area at that particular time, and my mother brought home Fats Waller records, and she was telling me how great Fats Waller was, and I used to listen to this thing called the Dixieland Jubilee. So I started listening to records. I didn't know anything about music or anything, but I started listening to that kind of music. And then in school, I was at a party, and there was some kid there playing and then all the girls were coming around the piano and to watch him do this, and I said, gee, that's interesting. I better go home. So I went home, and I kind of learned sort of a walking bass and kind of played around. And then the next time there was a function, I could sit down and be as appealing as he was.
And all the girls would come around and listen.
Yeah, and it was great fun. And then on the weekends, I'd sneak up to San Francisco and hear Jerry Mulligan, Chet Baker, Dave Brubeck, Paul Desmond, everybody who was out playing.
You had all the good guys.
All the good guys. And when we were doing the picture Bird, I remember I was with a lot of the musicians and Monty Alexander, a lot of good players, and they were all saying, but you actually saw Bird play. And they thought that was such a big deal. But to us, it wasn't in those days, because we saw Charlie Parker and Lester Young, Coleman Hawkins, all these guys were frequent pass buyers of the, because they were out on tour at that time.
Well, of course, I saw them all, too, in New York. You know, I was very lucky to be in the middle of things at the Hickory House, and everybody would come into Birdland, and see them all there. You know, I saw Bird play many times.
And yeah, it was an exciting era.
But how did you get into acting? Like, you had the first big show was Rawhide, wasn't it?
Well, that was later on. I was first. I was going to Los Angeles City College and. In the early 50s, and I was taking acting lessons on the side, and then I got a contract at Universal International, or Universal Pictures it was called then. I guess they changed it to Universal Pictures. And so I was a contract player there for a year and a half. Then I got out of there, and I started doing segments of little television shows, small parts, and then I got Rawhide in the late 50s. And that was my first steady job. As an actor.
You got big then. You got big time.
Well, it was big time. Having a steady job in acting is big time. Anytime you can have a steady paycheck is pretty good, and be able to go to work every day, because it's such a feast or famine business.
Well, then you went to Italy do those what they called spaghetti westerns, didn't
yeah,
you?
They weren't called spaghetti westerns at that time, but they later became that. I think the Japanese, they dubbed them in the distinction between American westerns and Italian westerns, they dubbed them macaroni westerns.
Oh.
And then it kind of went over to spaghetti westerns. And so that's where we were.
Well, there were so many wonderful shows that you did. I just don't have them all in order. Like, when did you do Play Misty for me? That was quite a while ago.
Well, that was 1970. And that was a picture a friend of mine wrote who was trying to start out as a writer. And she wrote this story about this disc jockey. And I found it intriguing. I found the whole thing intriguing, the sort of stalker mentality that you hear quite a bit about nowadays, but wasn't talked about too much in those days. And that misinterpretation of commitment, what have you. And so it became an interesting little topic. And I thought I could do it very inexpensively, so it would be a good first directorial job.
And it turned out to be a huge success, didn't it?
Yeah, it did well. It did very well. It cost, I think the direct cost without all the overhead and whatever else they tacked on was about $700,000 or something like that. And then and we had to pay $25,000 to get the song Misty. But
Did Errol play that?
Yeah, Errol Garner played, redid Misty, the song, his famous song, and we used his sort of solo recording of it as throughout the picture, and then we at the ending we had a big thing with him with strings, and it was great. I was always a big admirer of his, and to have him come back and do that was terrific.
Maybe I could be a ham and play you my version of Misty.
Yeah, that'd be great. Okay. I'd love to hear it.
Okay.
About music here in New York growing in the early days, and that was one thing. My great ambitions as a kid was to come back here and go to 52nd Street, but now of course you go down 52nd Street and it's all buildings. But I always thought, and my only association with it is building 52nd Street up again and for the picture Bird. But I never got a chance to come back here and listen to wander down the street and catch all those musicians.
What gave you the idea of doing a movie about Bird?
Well, it was a script in existence that belonged to another studio, and the other studio, I talked Warner Brothers into making a trade so I could have that one, and I could make the movie because I admired his playing so much. And when I read the script, I liked the script very much. So
did you meet him and talk to him?
No, I never did.
You never met him?
Never did.
Oh, you heard him, though.
But I heard him a lot, yeah. And he always I was always fascinated by, at that time, the doubling up everything like that was not the fashion. And
You mean playing everything double time?
Yeah. People just didn't do that. I mean, Coleman Hawkins was the more normal kind of soloing, and so when this guy came out, it was just like a whole other deal, and I didn't understand it, but I sure it was one of those things you kind of wanted to understand, and because he did it with such confidence and pizzazz.
You know what was so wonderful was that the album he made with strings. I was so glad that you featured that in the film. He played that gorgeous tune, If I Should Lose You.
Yeah, If I Should You Lose You, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it was great. And we took those original recordings and we just added more strings. It was interesting because we had a lot of recordings of him with nothing, just him, where they had mic'd his mic and everything else was kind of drifting off in the background. So what Lenny did is Lenny Niehaus, yeah.
Yeah, he writes such wonderful big arrangements of everything.
No, he's terrific, and he and I have co-written things together, but he's done the arranging of most everything. So what Lenny did is he got other newer musicians to come in and record and fill in the background. We brought back Ray Brown, and we brought back, and we had John Guerin on drums, and people like Monty Alexander and stuff would come in and play and fill it back up again, and in the same chord structure, and it was terrific because I felt there was nobody. You could get an imitator, I suppose, to imitate Bird, but to have the real thing was important to me.
Oh, it was masterful that you were able to do that, because I don't think anybody could approach him it wouldn't be anything like him, really, to have him made the whole thing so real. But you know, I was wondering if you ever played any tunes out of the Bird movie, like Now's the Time, or those are all blues that he did.
Yeah, well, Now's the Time. Yeah,
did you try?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was later stolen and made into the Hucklebuck. Remember the
yes.
song? They took.
You think they
a little bit of, well, there's a little bit of plagiarism there. I think maybe our influence.
There might have been
because they had that same riff. Da 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 da. Only his went da 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 da.
Well, that I think that goes into Now's the Time. Can I play a little bit
for you? Yeah, you play.
We'll let Gary Masrapi join in on bass.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Okay. Hear the full Piano Jazz broadcast. Tune in next week to your NPR station. Log on to pianojazz.org to find a station in your area. Piano Jazz is a production of South Carolina ETV and radio. Support for Piano Jazz comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, Baldwin Piano Company, the Friends of Piano Jazz, and NPR.